Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. It's the 24th of March and 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. Kind of a gray day, but that's all right. We'll get through that. And a little gray weather won't hurt us any. And we welcome you all. And it's really nice to know that you're there and hope that you'll stay with us as we navigate some pretty important stories this morning, as we do each and every morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Before we go full bore here, I would like to remind you that on Wednesday morning, this program is going to be broadcasting live from the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff, New York. And we are sold out. We're completely sold out. I believe the windowsills are sold out. We are full to bursting. However, you will be able to hear this on the radio. So I do hope that you join us on Wednesday morning. Two things. One, if you have a ticket already or have been notified that you have a ticket, either please come and enjoy and let us know that you're coming. Also, if you're not coming, let us know, and then we can take care of some of the names that are on the wait list, which would be great, so we will guarantee a full house. John Faso, Anna Markowitz, Mark Whitman, Amitava Kumar, Elizabeth Lesser, Dana Mengestu, Francine Prose, and Lucy Sant. It should be quite a conversation. It'll be happening from 9 to 11 on Wednesday, March 26th at the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff, New York. Again, it's a will call event, but tickets are accounted for. But if you would like to join us live on the radio, all you have to do is listen to us 9 a.m. Wednesday morning. All right, that is that. Let's get on to other things and introduce our group. We have a really good one today, so let's talk about who's here and what their expectations are for the morning. We go to Libby Post, political consultant and lobbyist. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. I don't know whether I can match the expectations for the morning, but we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, well, there are your expectations. You
oh, mine?
You set the goal,
oh,
and then we'll try to meet it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's as simple as that.
Thanks for letting me know.
We welcome Jim Ketter, a senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Welcome back.
Thanks. Yeah, I was in Florida for a couple days last week. I spoke to the Tampa Committee on Foreign Relations and the St. Petersburg World Affairs Council, both on jazz diplomacy, and it was interesting to talk in these current times about the projection of American soft power in a way that's been very successful over the decades, and talk about Voice of America, which may or may not be existing anymore. And I really was happy to see such a great turnout for both groups, that people are still coming out and engaging in important conversations. And it was also 75 degrees, and that was nice.
Yeah, that's very nice. I was telling Jim before when he came in this morning, I said, I was seeing your photos online. I said, everybody just looked like they were beaming. Everyone had a smile. And he said, right. And if they weren't, I didn't post that picture.
Yeah, right. Apparently, I was told at one of the events, and I didn't notice it, but somebody walked out on me.
Oh.
And so you know, I think I was at a point in which I was talking about the intersection between this kind of diplomacy and the American civil rights movement. So, you know, there were lots of people at both events. So if it's only one who walked out on me, I guess that's a victory.
That's what we like about radio, because if they walk out on you, you don't know.
Yeah,
you know, they just turn off their dial and I don't know. That sounds great. Terry Gibson joins us, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here. I just wanted to say how happy I am to hear that you're going to the Morton Memorial Library. I used to spend a lot of time there when I lived in Rhinebeck many years ago. It's a great place with great people, and I'm sure you'll do a great job.
It's one of my favorite libraries in the region. It's a beautiful, gorgeous library. They have a wonderful community room. They have a great, fantastic librarian. And it's just the most, like, comfy, beautiful library that you can find. So I'm very excited to be there, and I'm glad to know that you are familiar with it, Terry. How are things at Harvard? You still in business?
Still in business, going strong. Okay. Got more work than I can manage to do in a given day. The students seem to be happy. All is well.
All right, good. That's fantastic. Jennifer Burns joins us, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm always happy to be here. I'm good.
Excellent. Really nice to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here, and thanks to everyone for being here and being with us on this day. We have a lot to talk about over the weekend, and you know, we're in sort of that period where any of these stories could. What did I not say hi to Libby Post?
Am I chopped liver?
I thought I started with you.
Did you really?
Yeah, yes. You're the expectation bar for the day.
Oh, okay,
yes.
Fine.
Yeah.
All right, because I wanted to ask Terry a question.
Oh, ask Terry a question.
Are you relieved that they let you back on the plane and didn't handcuff you and take you someplace?
Oh, Jim.
Jim, sorry.
Me.
Right.
Yes.
Are you relieved that they let you back on the plane and...
You mean
TSA? Was it worrisome to you?
I think that's a bigger issue coming in through international borders.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, maybe traveling from Florida almost feels like you're
mm-hmm.
crossing.
Yeah, well,
an
you are
crossing.
Yeah.
I did notice that when I was looking up some directions when I was down there, that I had forgotten for a moment that Google Maps has changed the name to the Gulf of America. And so there I was, hard by the shores of the Gulf of America.
How nice.
Yes.
How nice. Because I have to go to Las Vegas in a couple of weeks, and I'm just a little like, are they going to let me get back on the plane? Or am I going to be whisked away someplace?
I mean, there are stories, and we can even we can get into them.
Although I am an American citizen, I was born here.
Right. You know, there's a lot of fear out there,
yep.
and a lot of it justifiable, and so we can certainly dig into that. Let's go to the topics of the day this morning. As I was saying, you know, really any of these topics could be our top topic. So I'm going to start with Greenland because we haven't really. Because we haven't really talked about this other than the initial proposal, and now it's gaining some steam. And when I say gaining steam, there's plans afoot and things that are happening. So I wanted to ask the panel about that. Now, Usha Vance, who is the second lady, and Michael Waltz, who is the national security advisor, are on their way this week, and Greenland officials are not happy. They say that this is aggressive. They're calling that move aggressive. Relations between Greenland and the United States sank further on Sunday as the Greenlandic prime minister erupted over what he called a highly aggressive delegation of senior officials the Trump administration said it would send to the island this week. Usha Vance, the second lady, Michael Waltz, the national security advisor, are among the officials headed to the island, which is a semi-autonomous territory of Denmark, though President Trump has vowed, both following his inauguration and in the State of the Union speech, to make it part of the United States, quote, one way or the other. Ms. Vance is scheduled to make a series of cultural stops after her arrival on Thursday, separate from Mr. Waltz. The National Security Advisor is supposed to be traveling earlier in the week with the U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright. The Prime Minister said on Sunday that Greenlanders' effort to be diplomatic just bounces off Donald Trump and his administration and their mission to own and control Greenland. He made the remarks, his angriest yet, to a Greenlandic newspaper on Sunday, and a high-ranking member of his party confirmed them. The prime minister seemed especially upset with Mr. Waltz's involvement. What is the National Security Advisor doing in Greenland? He asked. The only purpose is to demonstrate power over us. His mere presence in Greenland will no doubt fuel American belief in Trump's mission, and the pressure will increase. Other Greenlandic officials complained about the inopportune timing of the visit, pointing out that Greenland had just held parliamentary elections and that a new government has not even been formed. Terry Gibson, do you wish to start us off on this particular topic?
Well, I was intrigued by the way they used the words cultural visit, the visit of culture. It just strikes me as odd, because if there was ever an administration in the United States that was completely disinterested in anything related to culture, it's the Trump administration. So the idea that they are somehow expressing interest in Greenlandic culture, even though they have zero interest in American culture, is just odd and insincere and so easy to see through. None of this is really believable. The idea that our country has so many real issues affecting its citizens, affecting all of us, anyone who is living here in the United States, whether it be economic or education or healthcare, but to all of a sudden make this be a priority over everything that's happening here in the U.S. It seems just, I guess, par for the course for administration that is continually misguided, seems to have no real plan, and is really acting at the whims of a real estate mogul. And this very much seems like a real estate move. And just seems inappropriate, bad timing, and distasteful and embarrassing, really, as an American.
I do think it's important to point out that this was something that Donald Trump has mentioned here and there over the years, but nobody really took it very seriously, and it seemed more of an open question, and nobody really thought about it. It was not mentioned during the election season at all. It was not brought up as a main topic. It wasn't until after the election, and he was the president-elect, that this became a key issue and one that he kept mentioning over and over again. Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, Donald Trump did bring this up toward the end of his first term, and so this isn't the first time that it's come up. And I don't recall it coming up much in the 4 years that he was out of office, and as you said, Joe, not during the campaign. But it's a refrain now. And Donald Trump says this is for national security reasons. Well, Denmark, and therefore Greenland, is part of NATO, and we have a military base there. So anything that we might want to be doing vis-a-vis our specific national security interests can already be done. And if we wanted to renegotiate the nature of that base or what we can do, and, you know, our submarines are all over those waters, you know, we could certainly do that. And I don't think it would be that difficult to do within the confines of those NATO relationships. But I think we have to take seriously that the Trump administration has realigned American foreign policy to work more in coordination with Russia. And as I said the last time I was here, if you look at the map from the top of the globe, you see in the Arctic, particularly the waters that are melting now because of climate change, you see Canada, Greenland, and Russia, right there, close by each other. And so I think that we have to take this realignment with Russia very seriously, and therefore we need to see these other maneuvers and these statements not just as kind of like random nonsense that Trump is spouting, but it's so consistent and these visits are so provocative that there's something more going on here than meets the eye.
Any idea what that is in the sense of, you know, one of the things you say is national security, and I'm sure there are exceptions, but it seems like you could say that about any country or any part mm-hmm. of land, in that the more you have, the more land you have, the more countries you quote unquote own, that could be beneficial. So it seems like a weak premise.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would actually say that if you're in the business of trying to own other countries and they're actually pushing back on that attempt to own, that actually could diminish our national security posture. But as I said, we're already in a close alliance. I mean, the most successful alliance in the history of all alliances, NATO. And so there's nothing more that we really need from Greenland, occupying it somehow, controlling it, having it be the 52nd state. You know, all of this would just not matter at all in terms of national security. We wouldn't get anything more than we already have. But if we controlled it in coordination, perhaps even secretly in coordination with Russia, Russia would certainly benefit from it, particularly in terms of the Arctic.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from both Jennifer and Libby on their thoughts on this topic of Greenland and the fact that Greenland officials are expressing fury over the Trump plans to send a delegation to that country. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 24th day of March. And we're talking about Greenland and what is going on there as far as the United States' interest in Greenland and sending a delegation over to that country. We heard from Terry and from Jim. Now we go to Jennifer Burns.
So this to me just seems like straight old school geographic territorial imperialism, right? Like that's
a good way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just take land and then we'll use it. That way we also don't have to deal with any of the policies or economic tariffs or any of those other things. And I think in Greenland, it complements, and we were talking about this during the break, being able to extrapolate the raw earth materials, those things that Trump and Putin are obsessed, of course, with having. And yes, every nation needs them, but they're obsessed of it's not about doing business with other people to extract them. It's about tangible land to dominate them, right? So it's so problematic in the sense that, to me, that part is very, very straightforward. It's the other stuff when you get into NATO and how that ripples out into other international relations that becomes more complicated and I think makes it harder for the American people to follow. So many of them who like strongman ideas think that this is a good idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without all of the information and how it's going to adjust all the international communities, tariffs, which Trump is talking about, policies, support initiatives, and all of those other things that will reverberate back.
Libby Post.
Well, similar to what Jennifer was saying, Greenland is like that shiny new object over there. So go look at that. Go pay attention to whatever it is stupidly that I am saying about Greenland and that we're going to take it over, which we all know is never going to happen. But don't look at what the real consequences of my actions are over here, mm-hmm. where, you know, we're going after Medicaid, possibly Medicare and Social Security, although that's the third rail of politics. And if, you know, I can't, they'll make it more difficult, but they're not going to take it away because seniors vote in this country mm-hmm. and all of us are getting our Social Security now. Well, not all of us, but many of us are. And so, you know, I think that this is just another way of him deflecting, which he's very, very good at. And also confusing his base, because what do they know about any of this? But the reality of this actually happening, I mean, does he really want to start World War something? I mean, maybe it's World War 2.5 and not necessarily 3, but it is, you know, you just can't say
Falkland-esque.
Right. Larry Falkland-esque. I mean, we just can't say, oh, we're taking it over. I mean, come on. But, you know, if they want that, be able to drill, baby, drill, mm-hmm. the rare earth stuff, the oil, whatever it is, it's up there. There's financial considerations for them and his cronies and the people that he wants to help make money or himself to aggrandize himself. I mean, you know, Musk is making millions, billions off of government contracts while he's saying, cut this, cut this, cut this. I mean, locally we had a big, some big rallies around saving the post office, right? The American Postal Workers Union was out. My dad was a postal worker. The one time they struck, I walked on that picket line. I was 10 years old. It was really kind of cool. My parents never let us cross a picket line. So, you know, it's like, it really is this distraction, and he's very good at the politics of distraction. Because remember, folks, his big quote from 2016, I love the uneducated. And when you love the uneducated and you're cutting the education department or destroying the education department, making it more difficult for people to learn, you will have the ignorant masses just following this man because he hates the same people they hate. And he blames all the country's maladies on the same people that they do. You know, that's why we have this whole DEI onslaught. I mean, it's just absurd. It's absolutely absurd. I saw something on Facebook with Tucker Carlson saying, well, I know if a black woman doctor walked in, I would probably not get the same kind of care because quality of care because it was a DEI hire and she just, you know, was able to get into medical school. And I'm thinking, you still have to pass your boards. You still have to do everything you have to do to be a good doctor. It doesn't matter what the color of your skin is. You know, it's about them refusing to recognize that anybody who's not white has a brain. It really is.
Or the doctor may be really smart and know that it's Tucker Carlson.
Well, there is that. But I didn't want to go there, Joe.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, let's slip this man a Mickey, shall we?
But I mean, even think about this, right? So Greenland, Denmark, but now on Google Maps, it's the Gulf of America, right?
Right.
So. And the Gulf of Mexico as a waterway is, I don't want to say owned, but it is controlled by Mexico. They're the ones who have the legal authority over the water there. So it goes back to, again, though, saying whatever you want, which is now this is going to be the Gulf of America, we'll have Greenland, then pronouncing... Right, you just pronounce that it'll have a new name. Mm-hmm. It implies that it's your territory, even though on the books and in paper it's not. And it just opens the door then for other people who say access the map of the Gulf. Now it says America. I mean, what if Trump then says, well, we're going to call that section of Greenland this other name.
Right.
And then requires Google and all of them to do that. It appears that you control them, even though at the ground level you don't.
Well, maybe, I mean, the thing that, and perhaps I'm oversimplifying this, but the CEO of Google was in the second row of the inauguration, was behind the family, had better seats than former presidents.
Yeah.
So it seems that there's an in there, right? I mean, with all of these tech giants, not just those in charge of Google.
Mm-hmm.
So it's harder than if you say, hey, buddy,
yeah, right.
I'd like this on the map.
Right.
Well, okay.
Right.
All right.
Right.
How do you get to the bottom of that?
Well, and then you get people, though, right? Going back to Lizzie's, or sorry,
whatever
Libby's,
you want to call me, it's fine.
you know, comment about the uneducated. Sometimes it's not even just people who are uneducated. It's, say, the younger generation who then pull up a map, and now all of their projects are identifying locations as if they're American territories when they are not. So the ideas then that they have about how international countries are working or how they are governed and by whom they're governed will be altered.
Right. This is really ours.
Right. Right.
When you think about where, well, I want to get into, when we come back from break, we'll take some letters here, but Canada, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's another... Yet another, and you mentioned Panama. So there is a theme here. Matthew said the Trumpian idiocy about Greenland could be shot down quickly and in a very simple manner. Denmark simply needs to fortify Greenland and state unequivocally. If you want it, you have to come and take it.
Mm-hmm.
Even as nuts as Trump and his administration are, they certainly would not start a war with the European nation. Does everyone agree with that?
No.
Okay. This is the same thing Trump has always done, make outlandish statements and claims as negotiating tactic. Everyone caves. It is time for someone to not cave. We know he won't use the military in anything larger than a few bombing runs against nations or groups without many allies, because he is afraid to do military things. Embarrass him, call his bluff, do it, Denmark.
You know, this makes me think, too, though, that it could well be that the goal of the Trump administration on all of this is not to actually take over Greenland, but is to further drive another wedge into NATO. Mm-hmm. I mean, Trump has complained about NATO mm-hmm. countries not paying their fair share for their own defense. Previous presidents have complained about this, too. He just has complained about it in a more vociferous way. But if you really want to start to destroy the NATO alliance, how better to do that than to threaten the sovereignty of two of the entities, one, Greenland via Denmark, and two, Canada, mm-hmm. both NATO allies, and to say over and over mm-hmm. and over again, we're going to violate their sovereignty. Also, Trump was meeting with the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, who's the former Prime Minister of Netherlands, and was saying, well, maybe we'll need NATO's help to help us take over Greenland.
What is he, out of his mind?
And that's an open question.
I mean,
and so, you know, the he seems intent on really damaging NATO, and you know, this is, again, one has to wonder, why is this? Not beyond just saying he's making bizarre and random statements, what is really going on here? And who really benefits from the destruction of NATO?
Let's take a break.
Russia.
Okay, Terry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, Russia benefits. And Jim's already talked about this before, but I do think it's important to pay close attention to this. There's all the noise that's distracting and confusing, but then there's what's going on behind the scenes that we don't really have access to. I think all of this relates very much directly to the negotiations, whatever they are, between Ukraine and Russia. I think that talk about Greenland, amongst many, many other things, are being discussed in a way to reach some kind of deal with Russia. And I think Jim is right to be suspicious of this, because if there's one country that is definitely not going to let the United States just outright own Greenland, it's Russia. That would be a direct threat to their military security, depending on who was president at what time in the future. So they're not just going to let that happen. So there has to be some type of deal made there for that to be able to happen with Russia. If you want to avoid some kind of actual conflict. And I don't think Donald Trump has the guts or the will or even really the support to enter into some type of a war over any territory, certainly Greenland. And there's also the precious minerals there that are a big deal. I think that those resources are hard to find. They are hard to access. And all of the future technology relies heavily on them, and so that's playing a role as well. So I think there is good reason to be deep in here. And let's also remember that Donald Trump, at the end of the day, is always in this for himself. It's not for the American people. It's not for anybody other than himself and possibly his family. See how they can benefit. Always plays a role. We can't forget that.
Ricky writes, when we look at the map of the Arctic, we see Russia, Canada, Greenland, and Scandinavia. But let's not forget Alaska. America already has a strong presence in the Arctic. We'll end there on this topic. And when we come back, we'll move on. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And let's see. We want to move on to other topics. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So let's talk about some more growth opportunities for the United States. Canada has called snap elections. Mark Carney calls snap elections in Canada amid the Trump threats. Now, he's the new guy, right? Only been prime minister for about a week and a half. And he has called for general elections to be held on April 28th, cementing on the calendar another major event as the country experiences one of its most tumultuous and unpredictable periods. President Trump has imposed painful tariffs on Canada and said more are coming, while also threatening its sovereignty, turning on America's closest ally and trading partner, and upending decades of close cooperation in every sphere. We are facing the most significant crisis of our lifetimes because of Donald Trump's unjustified trade actions and his threats to our sovereignty, Mr. Carney said, speaking to the news media in Ottawa. President Trump claims that Canada isn't a real country. He wants to break us so America can own us, he added. We will not let that happen. We're over the shock of the betrayal, but we should never forget the lessons. Mr. Carney is 60 years old, a political novice with a long career in central banking and finance, who was only elected leader of Canada's Liberal Party on March 9th and was sworn in as prime minister on March 14th. It is March 24th. He replaced Justin Trudeau, who led the Liberals for 13 years in the country for nearly a decade, but had grown deeply unpopular. Mr. Carney had been widely expected to call for a quick election. He does not have a seat in Canada's parliament, and the Liberals do not command a majority, meaning that their government was likely to fall in a vote of no confidence as early as Monday had they not called for the election. The Liberals' main opponents are the Conservatives, and their support seems to be waning because of the Trump threats. Before Mr. Trump took office, the Conservatives had been ahead by double digits in the polls, and a victory for them seemed a foregone conclusion. But voters have grown concerned that the Conservatives are too ideologically similar to Mr. Trump to stand up to him, and many are drawn to Mr. Carney's economics and his experience and long career on the international stage. Jim.
Yeah, as your intro just said, a few months ago, Justin Trudeau was, I think, something like 25 points behind Pierre Poilievre in polling about an upcoming election. Then I think the election would have to happen by October, but having this snap election is done for all the kind of parliamentary maneuvering that you were talking about, Joe, in the intro. And so, you know, Donald Trump has inserted himself into these Canadian politics and actually has ended up really seriously undermining the one who was most likely to be Trump-esque, Poilievre. And it looks like a dead heat now. There are two other main parties that are also part of this picture. And, you know, the Liberals have had minority governments before, so they could well need one again. And so what happens with those other parties also matters quite a lot. And, you know, I think that it's a short campaign, unlike ours, that go on forever. And so maybe that augurs well for Mark Carney because he is a political novice. And I think it would probably be difficult if he were in a long campaign and, you know, maybe weaknesses would be revealed just because he's a newbie on the campaign trail. But I can't remember when the election is. It's early April,
it's
right?
It's coming up.
Yeah. So it's really quite soon. Yeah. And then how this all plays into this kind of constant drumbeat of the U.S. administration saying they're going to be the 51st state. They have to be annexed. Trump has also said that the border is artificial, that border treaty is null and void, that the agreement on who gets what part of the Great Lakes is null and void. This is really, again, it's astounding. This is a NATO ally. This is our neighbor. This is one of the most important trading partners to the United States. It is just absolutely outrageous that this is happening, and yet here we are.
April 28th, by the
okay.
way.
Thank you.
Jennifer.
You know, it just sort of struck me that the behavior, the pattern here is everything Jim and everyone else is saying, and it's become clear that you could pluck out the word Canada and put in Greenland, right? Mm-hmm. Pluck out those two and put in Panama. Pluck out that, put in Mexico, right? Pluck out that and put in Colombia, right? This is sort of I don't know the word I'm looking for, but it's sort of just the playbook in which you continue to throw it all out there, apply it universally by just changing the mm-hmm. name, and then you sort of see where the chips fall and how people move, and then you continue to do that in ways and hope along the lines that you've found the weakest economy or you've shined light on who will really back who in new and different ways, right? Yes, there's NATO, but who else will start to work with each other? And in some ways, I think people who support the Trump administration see that as, you know, really wise to do, because it's a reconfiguring of the board for them and a way to then, not just with Ukraine, but with other nations, hit the one that's got the least power or backing from other people, right? And that warps my brain to think about, because I'm not coming from, you know, that side of looking at things. But I can see, but I can see why people, and it's a strong man mentality, but I can see why people think, don't necessarily see that as the strategy or the methodology, I guess I'll say the methodology, but why it becomes so appealing, because it's the same behavior. And people are attached to that behavior, right? They like the demonstration of that behavior. You know, and I think more and more people, because the other thing that's happening is the tariff war that's taking place is hitting different people's pockets in different ways, right? Because some of it's rolled back, other parts aren't rolled back. And because it's happening so quickly, I think it's difficult to really see where the groundswell will be solid in the United States against these kind of behaviors towards Canada. Because for some groups, like steel and others, right, I think they were the ones who were in aluminum were saying this will be good, right? But not if you're in, but it depends on what state you're in. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take some time really to see who is the, if they'll come together in multiple different areas to say, no, this kind of tariff thing is universally not good for all industries.
Anyone.
Right.
All right. We are just about to a break, so we're going to pause there. When we come back, we'll hear from both Terry and Libby on this and move on. We welcome your letters on this subject and others that will be marching toward as we continue our second hour. We welcome you, and we hope that you will take part. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We've been talking about Greenland, now talking about Canada. We have heard from two of our panel members and would like to hear from the other two, and we welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, is here. We also welcome senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, who we will have kick off hour two.
All I have to say is if he tries to take over Canada or tries to, you know, annex either the Panama Canal or Greenland, you know, A, like I said before, it's him diverting attention to things that really will never happen, right? So that he can keep doing what he's doing domestically and further erode our rights, our free speech rights, you know, of people, you know, these folks that were the woman from, I think she went to Iran, the doctor, went to visit family, and
She went to Lebanon.
And then she was there for the funeral of a Hezbollah leader, and they saw it on her phone, so they automatically said, well, you're a terrorist, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, more of that is going to happen. Part of the problem is the majority of people in this country don't care. It's number one. And when they start coming after our own free speech rights, a lot of people, especially Trump's backers, will parcel it out and be like, well, I'm not saying those things, so they're not going to come after me. This is very much like World War II, you know. But those other people, you know, they deserve to go to jail, or they deserve to, you know, be detained, or whatever it is that they're going to do to us, because it is us. Let's be honest here. It is us. The attack on academia, the attack on law firms, the attack on basic civil rights and our ability to express ourselves freely, the attack on our right to assemble. I mean, all the basic freedoms in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution are under attack. And because, as I said before, he hates the same people his base hates, they don't care, because they'd like to see all of us in jail. But then again, if they do something like that and put us all in jail, not that that's really going to happen, but if they put us all in jail, gee, they're going to have to raise taxes in order to pay for our incarceration, because it is going to cost money to do that. As we all know, it costs way a lot of money to do that. And so they're just, you know, he's saber rattling to get people's attention onto something else that will never happen. Is he really going to risk World War III? Is he really going to try to annex Canada when they're a sovereign nation unto themselves? They're part of the Commonwealth. So, okay, then you're going to make an enemy of Great Britain, which includes England, Scotland, Ireland, Canada, and Jamaica, and a couple of other places as well. So it's just, this is part and parcel of the notion that, or the fact that he really doesn't understand what his job is, yet he is so totally taken with having power that he will exert it in any way he possibly can.
Well, so then I think the question is, when we're looking at Canada, how do Canadians feel, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're going to be the voters in this special election. And yes, some have bolstered the Liberals by adding sort of the third party to them, because it appears many are very unhappy with their Trump-esque conservative option, right? Which is, how do I say his name?
Pierre Poilievre.
Poilievre, right? So the question is, if he or the conservatives end up getting the majority in the Canadian government, does that mean that they will be more willing, or he will be more willing, and their parliament, to work with Donald Trump in ways that they're giving up territory, or making kind of like that territorial deal that Trump was talking about for the ceasefire in Ukraine, right? Is that right? That's what it was. We will control some of these natural resource places and extrapolate with the agreement with Russia, and that will help bring the war to a close.
maybe.
But so will who they elect? I mean, we're seeing Canadians respond in the media against the ideological ways that Poilievre and Trump are alike.
Mm-hmm.
But will the Liberals and the far left there be strong enough to really push back? And will some of those conservatives feel that it feels too American-esque and pull back from Poilievre?
I mean, premier of the province of Alberta has traveled to Mar-a-Lago, has met with Trump and Trump people. And so, at the provincial level, you have real splits depending on who's in power in these different provinces, how much they want to work with Trump. And so even in the face of Trump saying, we're going to take you over, mm-hmm. you see some in Western Canada saying, well, we want to work with Trump, and this is all a function of how terrible Trudeau was.
Right.
And, you know, we need to find a way to engage with the Trump people in a positive way. What that really turns into, though, as you were saying, Jennifer, I mean, given what Trump is saying, what really happens from that?
Right.
Terry Gibson.
I guess I wonder what the tolerance level of the American people is for all of this discussion about Greenland and especially Canada. I think it's very difficult for the average American, regardless of what political party you belong to, regardless of your beliefs, I think it's really hard for them to think of Canada as an enemy. It's really hard to think of Greenland as an enemy. It's just difficult to picture those populations being a threat to us in any real way. And a significant part of our country has really good relationships with Canada, whether it be at the trade level or just them literally being neighbors. You know, the northern half of our country has large populations that regularly cross borders for work and for family. And so I just think this whole discussion has a limit. I don't know what the limit is, but it's certainly not Canada's fault that people can't find an affordable place to live. It's not Canada's fault that the price of eggs stays high. It's not Canada's fault that our healthcare system is a mess. All the things that the average American is struggling with right now and has been for quite some time, it's not Canada's fault. So how much longer are they going to tolerate a president focusing on these crazy, absurd ideas about taking over other countries instead of really focusing on the issues here at home? It is a distraction, but I just don't know how long it will be effective.
Can I just say, though, that, Terry, I think that one thing that is an important element of this story is that for, you know, really understanding how much Justin Trudeau was seen as the poster boy for the most woke of the woke,
mm-hmm.
and was just like on a daily basis, an hourly basis, was part and parcel of the U.S. right-wing media ecosystem. And they just hammered this point home over and over and over again. So the result of this, I think, is now we see many in the Trump base who see the liberals of Canada as an enemy.
Right.
They might not see Canada overall as an enemy, but this has happened this has gone on for so long, this drumbeat has gone on for so long that I think it's been very effective, and it's had a lasting effect, and it's allowed Donald Trump to say these things with no real downside from his own base. In fact, I think quite the opposite. They're cheering it on.
Several letters on this topic. Michael writes, I think we should stop thinking about Trump rationally. What he is a megalomaniac. Then Micah says, many maybe think of it as a commercial real estate. If you're selling and buying apartment buildings, developments, office buildings, etc., you're not thinking about the people living their lives in those buildings. You're just thinking about the financial value of those properties to you. Trump, who forgets that he is a servant of the American public, just thinks of countries, including ours, as pieces of real estate whose value and resources should belong to him. Then we go to Robert, who takes issue with the section that I read from the New York Times setup that said that the Prime Minister of Canada, Carney, does not have wide experience in the public sector. He not only headed the Bank of England, he also ran ran the Bank of Canada and was senior associate finance minister in Canada as well. That from Robert. Then we go to
I would just also add to his resume, he was the goalie on the Harvard hockey team.
Well, there you go.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep.
I didn't know that.
Go Harvard.
Yeah.
Allison writes, might there be something in Project 2025 about foreign policy that might give us a clue as to what is going on? And Lev says, or Levi says, the greatest challenge I believe we face at the moment is how to diminish Trump and MAGA's support base. The specific problem is our neighbors' continued willful ignorance. You can yell to your bull in the face all of these facts about Trump's actions to his supporters. Trump supporters in all likelihood disagree with all of the Trump threats against NATO, imperialistic goals, etc. But the real challenge is that MAGA supporters clearly wish to remain willfully ignorant. Panel, have you any ideas that you can share with us to what will break through the willful ignorance of our fellow Americans? I don't care who's president. That's a hard question.
Right, because we're fickle. I mean, we are fickle, and sometimes we have these expectations that our leaders are going to be perfect, and they're never going to be perfect, and that they're going to solve all of our problems, and that's not going to happen. But we are in a place now where people who routinely didn't vote before, who felt like, why should I vote? It doesn't make a difference in my life, are now coming out to vote because Trump is their clarion call mm-hmm. for change. And that's why we're seeing this change in voter demographics. So we have to understand that. And going into either our local elections, because we have local elections here coming up in June primaries and November generals, and 2026, we have to do the outreach to the voters on our side who feel like voting doesn't have an impact on our lives, so why should we do it? And there are plenty of people who are registered Democrats. I can tell you this. Registered Democrats do not come out to vote on local elections, and they really need to come out and vote because, and I'll say this to them blue in the face, the Republicans have made their inroads over 40 years now, if not more, in school board races, library board races, town board races, town justices, and these people end up being state Supreme Court justices. They end up being assembly people and senators, and then go on. So we have to do our job of making sure that everyone gets out to vote in the primaries as well as in the general election.
Anita writes to us and says, dear panel, there are so many reasons not to antagonize Canada and Canadians, but I would just like to point out one of them. For the past 10 years, my husband and I have spent a lot of time in the Adirondacks near Lake Champlain. We have had many discussions with small business owners who have been very honest, describing the fact that 30 to 50% of their business in the summer is from Canadians. The effect on the tourism industry will be terrible. The part of New York where we spend our time is really quite Trumpy. But I wonder if this will help elect the Democrat in the upcoming special election. This is Elise Stefanik's district. One can only hope. That from Anita.
I mentioned that I was down in Florida for a couple of days, and people there are talking about this a lot because there are parts of Florida that really depend on Canadians coming there. And it appears that it's already had an effect, even at what is, I think, about to be the end of the snowbird season, that the number of Canadians coming are way down. And I think there's been reports on the numbers really down for summer rentals in various parts of the U.S. And Canadians are just saying, no, we'll vacation somewhere, but not in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And Lois writes, Alberta is Canada's Texas, oil and gas country, always one of the more right-leaning parts of the country. Don't assume it represents the rest of the country. Go out, check province by province. In fact, Musk's father came from right-wing populist social credit movement in Western Canada, then went to South Africa in 1950 because of his admiration for the new apartheid regime there.
And we can't. You know, this is something that's not being talked about a lot, is that Musk also supported apartheid in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
what he's doing to the government and through Doge and all the programs that he has cut or whatever, you know, all the havoc he has wrecked, I think has his roots in hating people of color.
Oh, absolutely.
And no one's talking about that. Nobody's talking about how he's trying to create an apartheid state here in the United States or recreate it.
Well, I think people have. I mean, I've spoken to people about it and I've suggested it, and it immediately gets shut down because it's becomes part of the woke, you know, so you get this vitriol about it being woke. But then it gets caught up in sort of the culture and identity politics part that is just so convoluted right now, right, that you can't actually get the point across that the system of government that he's encouraging is the authoritarian, and then you get into the A word there, and then people really back off in the conversation because that's essentially the model through which he's using through DOGE, and the Trump administration seems to be on board with setting up that very similar thing,
Absolutely.
Right? And you can't see the results of it because if you dismantle certain parts of the government, and especially the ones in which keep track of racial demographics and other things like that, then there's no records to show where the racial disparities are or where the inequality in the system is. Right? You can't prove it to argue against it.
And hasn't Trump also come out and said that the United States will, under his administration, give special visa status for white South Africans?
I don't know if he said white, but he did say South Africans with money. I didn't hear white.
He said white South Africans who have been displaced from their land, I think he said.
Right, so even there, it's a pushback against the end of apartheid.
Was that part of the cash deal where you would get the gold card?
I think this was separate.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Ward. This whole thing, too, I find interesting. I mean, this is very anecdotal, but it's how Trump supporters seem to be in Trump's camp and yet upset about Elon Musk. So they had the NCAA wrestling championship in Philadelphia. Trump comes out, people go nuts, and then Elon comes out and they boo him. I mean, I don't know what you read into that. That seems interesting to me. Again, extremely anecdotal. Also, it happens in Philly. They'll boo anything. They'll boo Santa. So there's that. Yeah. But I don't know as far as how that plays out. I mean, it's certainly consistent with what we hear in the polls and people's concerns about, even within the GOP, concerns about what is happening when it comes to the actions of Elon Musk. All right, let's take a quick look at another story, and then we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll get into it a bit more. After that, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org is what it is, panel@WAMC.org. So the hottest ticket in town, the hardest thing to get into, is to see Bernie Sanders and AOC. Tens of thousands of people are going to their Fight the Oligarchy tour. It's taken place in cities across the western states, in Colorado and Las Vegas and I believe in California. And the two-time presidential candidate is drawing what those in those there as insane crowds. and what it shows is the last one was, I guess the first stop was in Omaha, Nebraska. Originally, they thought they were going to get 800 people, and then about 20,000 people showed up. So they had to move to a bigger venue. They went outside, and they were in Tempe, and they filled an arena. They had an overflow room, and now they're trying to do events outside. Sanders says, "This is insane. I'm not running for anything." People are outraged and they're frightened and they want to fight back. And this is one form of beginning the struggle to fight back. Probably had I thought about it more, I would have had Bernie Sanders and AOC on my bingo card as to who was going to first come to the to be the initial spokespeople for the Democratic Party. But I didn't. And here they are. And it tells us two things. One, you have a young person and an older person, and they are bringing in huge crowds. They have a united message. They are, I mean, they're certainly going after Republicans, and they're certainly going after Elon Musk. Well, they're not shying away from going after Democrats as well. Hello, Chuck Schumer. So and that is resonating with the people, and it just seems like there is such, Terry, I'll let you hit this first, but there just seems to be such a thirst for people to have to kind of go out and to hear what they perceive to be common sense on these issues. And to hear of from two people who actually have some plan to move forward.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's any secret. The Democratic Party hasn't really had a strong spokesperson for a really long time. You could maybe say going back to President Obama. And it's also important to remember that Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. But
right.
He is filling a void that Joe Biden wasn't able to fill. He was not a good communicator. He's filling a void that no other registered Democrat in elected office has been able to fill. They just don't have as big of a draw. Their microphone doesn't attract as many people. AOC is up there in the rankings, but even her voice does not draw as many people. And I think what's always been interesting about Bernie is that he draws a really diverse crowd. He doesn't just draw traditional Democrats. He draws a lot of people sort of in the independent category, a little more open-minded about going either way. His message really resonates across a diverse segment of society where people want to hear someone talking loudly about the things that are affecting them on a daily basis, really grassroots messaging, cost of living, economics, healthcare, all of those things. And his message is basically the same message he was saying back when he was running for president.
Oh, yeah.
It really changed.
No.
But, of course, none of the things that he's talking about have really changed either. We just haven't made a lot of progress on any of those issues. So I for one, am grateful to see finally somebody stepping up and grabbing a microphone and really trying to draw crowds and begin to be a leader. And I'm glad to see AOC right there with him. And I hope that he is a shot of adrenaline into the rest of the Democratic Party and that others will follow his lead, because we desperately need more people out there doing exactly what he's doing.
We'll get the thoughts of the rest of the group after a quick break. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll return after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning as we go forward in our last half hour together. We were talking about Bernie Sanders and AOC going on tour over the weekend. Very popular. Tens of thousands of people showing up in cities in the western part of the country. And this is all going to be coming east. And it's really fascinating to see, because so many people, and it has been just, it does seem to be clicking. It was on C-SPAN. The event from Colorado was on C-SPAN, and it's getting a lot of play. Libby, you've had your comments about Bernie Sanders over the years. I'm interested in what you make of all this.
Look, I'm glad somebody's out there rallying the troops. I don't agree with everything he says, but somebody's got to be out there, and AOC is the same way. Someone's got to be out there rallying the troops. AOC has tempered her rhetoric since she's been in Congress, and she learned a lot from Nancy Pelosi about how to actually get things done, because I don't care what your politics are. You still need to be able to deliver for your constituents. And so I'm glad somebody's out there rallying the troops, and I think Bernie's reluctance to talk about Chuck Schumer is indicative of the fact that again is another shiny object distracting the Democrats and the base from the work that really needs to be done. You know, on April 5th, there's going to be a large national movement of events across the country. We're going to have one here in Albany, and I think it's at 11 o'clock on the plaza by the Egg. And, you know, why not? We should be, all of us should be in the streets as much as possible. It's called the Hands Off Rally. And you can go to mobilize dot something. You can go to mobilize.us and just search for Hands Off and you'll find the local events. But, you know, this is what needs to be happening. People need to be peacefully assembling, expressing their opinions, letting it be known that we're not in favor of what's going on. And if Bernie and AOC are the ones to bring that message, I'm okay with it.
Terry Gibson.
I think you already called on me for this.
Oh, who did I miss? Jim, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I apologize. My score. You know what? I even have my little score sheet, my little score pencil.
Oh, I see.
And isn't that great? These were out on the table, and
I think they're like bowling pencils.
Yeah,
right?
or miniature golf, and that's what I thought we were going to do. But I picked one up, but I didn't take proper notes on that. Jim was the fourth person I call on. But Jim, go ahead.
It's an interesting phenomenon to see these two touring the country, but also. I think, you know, have to give some credit to Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut. He hasn't been out on the road, as far as I know, but he has been behind lots of microphones, and he has just been consistent in saying this isn't just kind of, you know, the politics of the old days, meaning 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. This is a new situation. This is an immediate crisis for the country, and we need to kind of have all hands on deck, and we need to understand the depth of this crisis. So Murphy, I think, has also been very good, and you've seen some governors stepping up as well. The governor from the state of Illinois and the governor from the state of New York, who I think has been consistent on this.
And
others, I'm sure, too. But I think governors will continue to play an important role because they also have the power to be governing and to be making certain choices in their governing of their states that have a real tangible opposition. And it's not just a rhetorical opposition.
What's interesting is, you know, you got Pritzker, you got Hochul, you have some other governors, and then you have Gavin Newsom, who is stepping on it every single time he opens his mouth. And he did this podcast and went after the trans community, and he's in California. I'm like, what are you doing? What are you? I mean, I know he's term limited and Kamala might be the next governor. Wouldn't it be great if Kamala was the next governor of California? I mean, that's what people are, you know, there's some chatter about that. I think that we're going to see more people as we get closer to 2026 coming out of the woodwork, taking on leadership roles. You know, all the talk about, oh, the Democrats are in disarray and blah, 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 blah. You could have said that about the Republican Party in 2008. You could have said it in 2012 when they lost both elections. You know, that's the basic trope. Oh, they're in disarray. They're going to lose. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. Well, they came back. The Republicans came back, right? And we've come back. So, you know, it's just that we had the best grassroots fundraising month for the DNC in years in February. So, you know, we just have to be patient. And I think it's because people feel so much pressure and that something has to be done right now because of how horrible everything is that's going on. People want things done immediately, and that's just not the way it works, unfortunately.
Some letters. We go to John, who writes, woke, that word, came from the African-American community and was referring to being on guard against racism. The attacks on DEI are all based on an assumption of inherent white supremacy. The attacks on DEI are all based on an assumption. Said that twice. You want something to do, fellow listeners? Start insisting that anti-DEI means promoting white supremacy. Start treating anyone who uses woke in a derogatory manner as saying, I'm a flaming racist.
Right.
Refuse to hear anything else. Time for us to start reverse weaponizing the right slogans against them. That from John. We go to Carol. I am sick and tired of the Bernie dissing I hear from the members of the panel. Today, a little grudging respect from Libby. Thanks a bunch.
Hey.
Wake up, you all. Bernie's message is powerful. I think we've been very nice to Bernie.
I think we're totally very pro-Bernie.
I think it's... get a grip. The first thing Libby said was...
I don't always agree with him, but I'm glad he's doing what he's doing. And AOC... Also, so I'm not sure what the problem is. And someone else wrote and said they love me, so I'm cool.
Wake up, y'all.
We love you.
I know you do.
Bernie's
so
message is powerful and connects. The large D Democratic establishment never supported Bernie. Look where that got them.
Can I ask Libby a question? Do we have time?
Yes, please.
Libby, what do you think the future holds for AOC? Stay in the House and rise up through the power structure in the House? Run for another office? In the U.S. Senate or some, you know, statewide office.
Well, people are talking about her running against Chuck when he's up, or primarying Chuck. He's up in 29, I think. So there's a lot of time between now and then. I think we have a better shot of taking back the House in 2026 than the Senate. So why would she leave and be able to rise up within the ranks there, and then look at the Senate? You know, down the road. But the thing is this, she has to appeal to upstate Democrats as well as downstate Democrats in order to win a primary against a 30-year incumbent. And so that will not be easy. But if Chuck decides to not run and she is the nominee, I mean, it'll be an incredible primary. But if she ends up being the nominee, she's going to have to move to the center, because you're going to have people like Mike Lawler and Lee Zeldin and the others from the right painting her as, you know, a communist. And that's the challenge she's going to have to overcome.
Or maybe better for her to stay in the House and just rise up the ranks.
Right. Yes. She could probably have much more, not much more power, but she can probably be more powerful within that structure and be able to deliver more for her constituents.
Vincent writes to us and says, as a lifelong Democrat and a former Democratic elected official, the party needs a dramatic and comprehensive overhaul, not just tinkering around the edges or new slogans. This is a new world with new and dangerous challenges, and these times call for bold action. Then we go to Stuart to paraphrase Paul Simon, still feeling the burn after all these years. Then we go to Dusty, who says, I watched the rally in Colorado on C-SPAN. I've never really heard AOC speak, but she is magnetic. Mm-hmm. Bernie was Bernie, but she sounded commanding and focused on doing something about this mess and rallying the troops for the cause. That from Dusty. Okay. Yes.
Just so you know, this just came over AP. The Trump administration, this should not be a surprise to anyone, is asking the Supreme Court to halt a ruling ordering the rehiring of thousands of fired federal workers from several agencies.
So what?
Not a surprise.
But we hear that, and then I don't know what happens. Like, where do they go? Do they come back? What?
Well, the USDA had to hire everybody back. Oh, because, oops, there's the avian flu, and with bonuses. So, yeah, they will hire people back. I mean, it's insane, but that's what they'll have to do.
Back and forth. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up our program, and we'll be done for this Monday morning. That's the sad part. The good part is we still have 15 minutes with this wonderful assortment of individuals. We will get to that in mere moments. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will be back right after this. Two quick things before we go on to a new topic. Jim, I believe, writes, we need a new constitutional amendment requiring presidents to be over 79 years old. Okay. different than what we usually hear. And also, hey, Libby, could we hear again the website to protest in Albany, please?
Yes. So one moment, please.
And I'll let Libby look that up, and she can give that in mere moments. And
you ready?
Yep.
Okay. So it's mobilize.us/hands-off/event/ 764-273.
Okay. Or just look up Hands Off Albany. Or,
right. Or you can Google Hands Off Albany or just go to mobilize.us and search for Albany, New York.
All right. Very good. Domenico, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for checking in. Let's go to some of our last topics on this Monday morning, as we only have about 10 minutes with one another. Oh, I don't know about this story. I find it fascinating, but the Easter egg roll is now going to have corporate sponsors. This is what we've we're learning. There is a new guest at the annual Easter egg roll. It's a tradition that stretches back to Rutherford B. Hayes. That is what we know Rutherford B. Hayes for. He started the White House Easter egg roll. And it's a chance to showcase brands, according to the White House. They want to recruit corporate sponsors to contribute to its Easter egg roll, raising ethical and legal concerns that President Trump is allowing companies to profit from the 147-year-old tradition by turning it into a showcase for their brands instead of, you know, an event for kids. The financial backers of the April 21st event would be able to choose from three options that cost between $75,000 and $200,000. That, according to a 9-page guide for potential sponsors that was reviewed by the New York Times. The most expensive package includes a corporate booth, logo placements, branded snacks, beverages, exclusive tickets to brunch with the First Lady, a chance to engage with the White House press corps, okay, a private White House tour, and 150 tickets to the event. So if you're a $200,000 sponsor, you get 150 tickets to the event.
But do they really want these people engaging with the White House press corps?
Well, I would assume that's selected.
Yeah. You think?
Yeah.
Like Fox. Talk to the people from Fox.
As in the past, any money raised through the event will go to the White House Historical Association, a private nonprofit educational organization founded by Jacqueline Kennedy in 1961. The event is largely held without taxpayer dollars, with the American Egg Board, a marketing group for the egg industry, sponsoring thousands of eggs for the event, but without the kind of visibility laid out by Harbinger's Guide. Federal regulations prohibit government employees from using their public office for private gain. Richard Painter, who served as a chief ethics lawyer in the White House counsel's office under President George W. Bush, said that the White House was clearly breaking that code by allowing private enterprises to use an official event to showcase their brands and letting the proceeds flow into a private nonprofit. I do think it's a little rich that this is happening when we're having an egg shortage. But
there is that.
Although I believe they always, now they're saying that here they said sponsoring thousands of eggs for the event. My understanding is the eggs were always wood.
Hard-boiled.
Hard-boiled.
They are hard-boiled?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought they used to be wooden eggs.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
They weren't using real eggs because it was a waste of food. So they were using hundreds of wooden eggs that were made up. But anyway, Jim.
I mean, I don't even know what to say. It's another opportunity to have organizations plow in money to you know, God knows what. I mean, I don't know how this will be overseen and who's tending to the money and who's, you know, buying influence or not. I mean, I think it was off air that I mentioned, you know, the Trump coin. And I recently heard the member of Congress from Brookline, Massachusetts, Jake Auchincloss, who was talking about how this is, you know, really one of the most outrageous examples of potential presidential corruption, that people could put money into that presidential coin and it's anonymous, but then demonstrate privately to Donald Trump that they had done so as a way to seek favor. And so I don't know if the Easter egg hunt would be the same kind of thing. I assume this is on a much smaller level. But at the very least, it seems tacky to have the Easter egg hunt at the White House branded.
You know, what does your Easter bunny eat? Try Kent Blue Seal. Home fresh show.
Well,
17
Joe,
pound
I
bags just... of, yes. Yes, Terry.
Your mention of this brand just makes me think that the pricing here, the $200,000, $75,000, these are really small numbers for this type of event, for a corporate sponsorship at this level. So it's going to be attractive, not to the big corporations, which I think all would kind of shy away right now from being that closely related to the White House in a public way. It's one thing to do it in a private way, but to do it in a public way, to have my brand associated with the White House right now, I'm not sure it's beneficial to our profit margin. But for a smaller, much smaller corporation that already has built its brand around a conservative base, a right-leaning base, I think that's the type of brand we're going to see attracted to it. So something like, you know, Bob's driveway seal coating, might be, you know, more appropriate for this event.
I wonder if
nothing against Bob or people that coat driveways.
Right.
Yes.
But I wonder if the MyPillow guy has the $200,000 to do.
Mike Lindell? Yeah, I don't know. Or I mean, the Teslas may still be on the property and the in the lot. I don't know how that's going to work. But it is.
It's strange.
Yeah.
It's weird, right? Like, essentially, you know, and going to the point that this is or may be violating the law, which is seems to be a blurry line for some of
One they don't care about, right?
At different times. But, you know, when I read this, first I was like, wow, it'll look like a golf course, right? Like, it'll look like a golfing event where you go and all the sponsors have their signs up everywhere. So that will be part of the visual. But then also, like, does Melania know she signed up for this brunch?
I doubt it. I doubt she'll even be there.
Like you get tickets into a brunch with Melania. Like, she doesn't seem to be a person who's
would want to be first prize.
So that was odd too. But the visuals of this, not only like the crossing the line with the law, but the visuals of making this look sort of like a golf course. It seems a little quid pro quo-y in a weird kind of way, right? Who will give, who won't? Be a great opportunity for a big corporation who's got like a lower, new, struggling startup, right? People don't always see what's behind this new, smaller business that may be struggling. So there's a lot of odd things. And then my last thing that I really thought about was, why are you doing this for the Historical Society? Because you're anti-history in many ways. And it's the Jacqueline Kennedy Historical Society. So why are they intrigued or wanting to have this money be raised for that institution?
So that they can totally remake the White House to make it look like Mar-a-Lago. You know, enhancing the...
Is that what the Historical Society does, though? Is the history of the White House and maintaining the history of the White House? It does.
I mean, she was all about... Jackie Kennedy was all about maintaining the grandeur of the White House. And that when they came in, there wasn't any money to do that, despite the fact that they are coming off of the booms
but
of the 50s.
I don't know if there's a direct connection between the money that's being raised here and the project that they want to do of paving the Rose Garden.
Oh, I have a feeling they'll figure out a way to make that happen. Don't you?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I
have a feeling that, you know, they'll make that happen. And the thing that we've missed from the conversation about Canada and Greenland and, you know, is, well, new hotels might be going up. Right? New Trump hotels.
Wouldn't that be great if Greenland was a sponsor? Oh, that'd be fantastic. Come visit Greenland. That would be great.
All the provinces.
Yeah,
in Canada.
Fantastic.
And what do you get to sponsor? Do you actually get to sponsor a child who is searching for the eggs? Do you get to like put your brand on the child?
You get 150.
Could you imagine the betting on the racing of the children to put roll in the eggs?
Oh yeah, I can't
I don't like where this was going.
I know.
you get 150 tickets, so I guess that would be so your group would be able to bring kids,
right.
You know, from your
cuz Elon can bring all of his kids.
Well, I don't know if he has enough tickets.
Yeah, I don't either.
We'll end there on this Monday morning as this is turning in a direction that I'm worried about. My thanks to all of you. Terry Gibson, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. Libby Post, always good to see you. Jennifer Burns, wonderful. Welcome back, Jim. Thank you. We'll be back right after this.